This week, we have a special guest. We have Sarah Dye of Above Time Coffee Roasters. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Well, I am very much looking forward to enjoying a conversation with you. I've been told a lot about you and your family and your projects, and so I'm eager to dive in. Also, you'll notice scrolling across the bottom of the screen is the URL for abovetimecoffee.com, which is Sarah's business. And so I want to just dive into that. But first, I want to get some background about Sarah and her family. She first came on my radar a couple of years ago when I heard that people were protesting that a family with bad thoughts were selling produce at a farmer's market. So can you fill us in on that background, and then we can talk about how you created this coffee company?
Yeah, sure. Well, essentially, it kind of began with, I suppose, rumors spreading through what we had somewhat sort of considered our community, a quote unquote community, which was a nearby college town where we had been selling at a very prominent, very large farmer's market for a decade. My husband and I had a small scale organic farming business. We specialized in gourmet and heirloom type crops and, you know, organic produce and herbs and flowers and things like this. And we had sold there for 10 years. And some rumors started circulating among a couple of friends that I had had conversations with after discovering new truths back in 2015 and 2016. And there is a strong presence of whatever term people prefer to call them. They're known as Antifa or anti-white anarcho-terrorists, essentially. These sorts of people started coming to the farmer's market and harassing us at our booth during 2017 and 2018. And we also had fake blood put in our mailbox as well. So there was kind of a pattern of them trying to intimidate us then. And then in 2019, I was actually doxxed by Unicorn Riot as having previously been a member of Identity Europa. And when the docs became public, it blew up pretty big, bigger than a lot of doxes, in that these local anti-white activists contacted New York Times and Daily Beast and some of these larger publications and just blew it up. And there were, all throughout 2019, there were protests with hundreds of people at the farmers market carrying signs, handing out flyers, saying our produce was toxic and bad. So spreading all sorts of slander, but also accusing us of being terrorists. Talk about projection, right? And we had Antifa show up in what they call black block, which is where they dress all in black and cover their faces in black. It's an intimidation tactic and also a tactic that they use to hide their identity when they're planning to do illegal things. We had groups of those people show up at least on two occasions during the farmers market. And each time instances like this would happen, we would file police reports and maintain good communication with law enforcement and just document these situations and try to kind of, I suppose, watch our back, for lack of a better term. And it was chaos. And I can kind of speak about it in this sort of perhaps nonchalant sounding manner now, but that's because this was almost 3 years ago when this was happening. It was extremely stressful at the time. We also had these groups of people coming out to our property at least another time where they poured nails at the top of our driveway. And that was a part of a ring of vandalism that happened in the community. So it was just a terrible time. And some people have asked, why didn't we just leave the farmers market? You know, why did we keep going back and facing these people? But we just, the whole time, my husband and I were so angry that these people thought that they could do that, that they thought that they could just terrorize and intimidate innocent people, such as ourselves, law-abiding citizens, for having privately held views or perceived privately held views that the local leftists didn't like or disagreed with. We refused to let them get away with that. And one of the worst parts about the situation is that it wasn't just local Antifa activists and civilians that were doing this sort of thing, you know, your typical leftist. It was that the local city government was cooperating and aiding these activists. And the mayor actually went public with statements in support of one particular activist group called No Space for Hate that had formed around our situation and was one of the prominent organizers of the protest against us at the farmers market. He came out with statements of support. It is believed that he actually donated money to this organization as well. And they also utilized their own police force to intimidate me as well. I was alone in a meeting. Let's see. So it was the chief of operations of the Bloomington Police Department had invited me to a meeting to supposedly address my concerns over my family's safety at the farmers market. And it was in that meeting that he and the Parks Department director, which I should have mentioned, Greg, this farmers market was run by the city. So it was in that meeting where he implied that there was a sniper threat. And I know if anybody's heard me on podcasts discussing this before, I've mentioned it, but I feel like it's always important to mention again, because I still, every time I think about it, I just still can't believe that they would go this far, that the city would go this far to try to scare us away from the farmers market. It was, the city knew that they couldn't just kick us out of the farmers market. So they, you know, they were cooperating and being a part of all these protests and using intimidation tactics, essentially.
Was there a way that they could actually stop you from attending the farmers markets? There's no way of controlling that. So the city itself, the farmers market was run by the city, and they were themselves trying to scare you away?
Yes, exactly. So we ended up being able to get an attorney later that year in August or September. And we wound up filing a lawsuit actually against the city for a lot of this stuff that we're talking about here and what they did and their actions. And during the deposition of that, I forget his exact title, chief of operations director or something like that, our attorney was able to confirm that there had never been any actual threat of a sniper. You know, things like this. So it was just, oh my gosh. I mean, the city council chambers were filled week after week with dozens, if not hundreds, of people in what we once called our community who were giving speeches about us and the threat of, you know, quote unquote, white supremacy and how non-white people did not feel safe at the farmers market because of Schooner Creek Farm, which was my husband and I's farming business. And it was just absurd. I mean, the whole thing was absurd. It was almost as though they really wanted another Charlottesville.
So what percentage of the people in your town are white as opposed to non-white anyway?
Well, our town where we live, which is about 20 minutes outside of this college town, is majority white. I would say it's at least above 95% white. The local college town where the farmers market was held, I believe, is about 87% white. And I'm not sure if that includes, I don't believe that actually includes the student population.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. So you have an overwhelmingly white community that's going through all of this agitation about you possibly making a few non-white people who are around not comfortable. Were there any non-whites who attended this farmer's market? What was the ethnic makeup of your average farmer's market attendee?
Oh, well, it's certainly majority white. That particular town, which is Bloomington, has a fairly significant Asian population and a fairly significant Jewish population, but mostly white people who attended the farmer's market. And, you know, extra police were placed at the farmers market to supposedly help keep it safe. And then, of course, we had Antifa activists complaining that having more police present at the farmers market compounded the feeling of unsafety for non-whites, which, of course, as we know, is just ridiculous.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, some non-white groups do feel intimidated by the police. I guess I could see that, but maybe for good reason. Did you make any friends in your town over this? I know when people are doxxed and harassed that sometimes people who you thought were friends or colleagues, neighbors would turn against you. But at the same time, were there people who came forward and were sympathetic, either sympathetic to your views or just sympathetic to your rights? Did you get any positive, you know, support during this whole crisis within your community?
Yes, we did. We did. For a time, it seemed like there were quite a few new faces coming to shop from us specifically at that farmers market to support, like you said, our right to be there, even if maybe they didn't agree with what our perceived views were. There were still a significant amount of people who just still believe in free speech and were against what they were seeing the rabid left doing. Because of just that, you know, there were people who came out. Now, that wasn't enough to continue to sustain our business, though. So the business itself just basically went completely downhill over the past, you know, year and a half, a couple of years. But as far as customers go, that was the situation with that. And then on a personal level, yeah, we made quite a few new acquaintances locally. A lot of people who were Trump supporters and just considered themselves traditional conservatives, I suppose you might say, became friends or acquaintances over that period of time. However, unfortunately, with the launch of Above Time coffee roasters, where which sort of coincided with us with the lawsuit ending. I'm kind of skipping around. My apologies. Let me go back a little bit. While all of this was going on, and while we still had the attorney, and while we were involved in this lawsuit, we had been under the advice to still be very cautious about what we put out publicly on social media regarding our views and just what we said in general. And that is because we were expecting a jury trial. And once the lawsuit was over, it honestly felt like I was free, felt like we were free again, because there was no longer going to be some sort of jury to impress. And it felt like I could finally just, we could live in complete truth, if that makes sense. And so, with the launch of Above Time Coffee, being that a lot of the media stuff revolving around that, and of course, the name Above Time being a nod to Savitri Devi's work and these sorts of things, and explicitly serving the fellow white nationalist community, a lot of those acquaintances that had come about, those Trump supporting conservatives, kind of faded off. And you know, I got a couple of messages from them saying, "What are you thinking?" And then, and that's, you know, when those sorts of things happen, then you just kind of, that's like weeding a garden, and you realize, well, those aren't necessarily people that you need in your life anyway. But yeah, I would say in general, though, even if not very local to us in the state of Indiana, the nationalist movement is much stronger and much better networked now than I believe that it was back in 2019.
That's very encouraging. So were farmers markets shut down by COVID during the pandemic, or did those things continue fairly normally?
Well, if I recall correctly, I don't believe the market actually shut down, but especially being kind of a leftist town, there were a lot of extreme restrictions put in place. So just extremely controlled. There were only a certain amount of people allowed to enter the market, masks were required, social distancing was required, things like this. And so that was a turnoff, I believe, to a lot of, well, I don't know how to describe it, a little bit of a turnoff to some of the customers who just stopped attending. But actually, our particular farmers market, while we vended a little bit during COVID and when that was going on, they conducted a survey among the vendors, and over 75% of the vendors stated that they had had the best year that they had ever had that year. So yeah, I thought that was very interesting.
Okay, so tell us about Above Time. So you basically stopped your organic farm business and vending at this farmer's market. And so you transferred into another business. And can you tell us how you got into coffee roasting? And we can talk about how it's going so far. How did Above Time Coffee come about?
Well, in a way, it was kind of spontaneous. It's not something that we had ever considered. It had never crossed our minds to start a coffee business. And I think it was back in January or February, if I'm remembering correctly, a friend was visiting, and you know, we were having a great time, just as always is the way when you're visiting with a like-minded fellow nationalist, the conversations are rich. And amongst this time of visiting with this friend, the thought was mentioned, you know, why don't we have a nationalist-owned coffee company? We have the fantastic Laura Tallers Tea, which largely serves the UK and Europe, but in America, none of us could think of anything that was already happening here. So it seemed like a niche that could be filled very quickly and easily. And my husband and I love coffee. We've always been coffee snobs, for lack of a better term. And we thought, you know, that's a great idea. So kind of the more we thought on it, the more it really made sense that maybe this was the right thing for us to do. And it seemed perfect timing. And we had a friend who is very much a coffee guru, who was very knowledgeable about all things coffee and had a lot of experience with roasting coffee and all of this. And so we spoke to him about it, and he made himself completely available to us as far as answering all of our questions and offering guidance and advice on what equipment to look at and everything. And so it was things like that, one thing after another, where it really seemed like everything was propelling us forward in this direction. And because of that, it was just further affirmation to keep going forward. And then, you know, here we are now. We launched the company at the 1st of September, and we actually had to stop sales just last week because we were receiving more than we could handle. So
you were inspired in part by Laura Towler, by Grandma Towler's. That's interesting to know. And I'm sure she's very happy to hear about that.
Oh, yeah. We're big fans of Patriotic Alternative and everything that Mark and Laura and Sam and all of those great folks are doing over there. I feel like they're a huge inspiration in all of their activism that they're doing. Very much inspiring. So, yeah.
So how did you choose the name Above Time?
Well, my husband and I were sitting in the living room one evening and saying, you know, we really need to take some time to consider what we're going to call this coffee company. And I mean, Greg, it was within less than 5 minutes, it just immediately popped into my mind. It was like, I just heard the words Above Time Coffee. And I mean, obviously we were somewhat familiar with the concept, you know, above time and in time, against time. We're certainly not scholars of Savitri Devi's work, but my husband has read Lightning in the Sun a few times, and I have listened to the audiobook once, and we're certainly enamored with the bit that we do know about her work and her story and just the beauty and the poetic nature of her writing.
Well, that's very cool. Of course, I run the Savitri Devi Archive. That's the first website I actually created years and years ago with a collaborator named Gabriella. And it's still around. It's been going since 2006 now. And it's been revitalized this year, and there's a lot more new material going up there. And so, of course, I saw Above Time Coffee, and I thought, ah, Savitri Devi, they took some inspiration from her, which is very, very cool. I guess maybe we could pause here for a sec. Could you talk a little bit about how you came to be a thought criminal? How did you become concerned about white identity and white issues? And how did you get on the radar of these Marxists and liberals who have been harassing you?
Well, that's a great question, and it's a long story, so I'll try to stay on track. But in some ways, when I really think about it, it almost feels miraculous, to be honest, because I had spent a lot of time in this college town I've mentioned, and I was friends with a lot of leftists and feminists, etc., and I was pretty deeply steeped in this sort of thing. And, you know, it's almost embarrassing to say this today, but I was definitely one of these young women who was, you know, passionately saying, you know, all workers for equal wage, and kind of repeating these kind of communist Marxist ideas, but never having actually read the work of these, you know, communist writers, never actually having studied any of it, basically just regurgitating, like a lot of these young kids do in the college towns, just regurgitating what seemed cool and what was fashionable. I had also kind of been in the anarchist scene or anarcho-primitivist scene. I was Derek Jensen, if anybody's familiar with his work, I was kind of into this idea that civilization was really bad and that it was, you know, ruining the earth. And I believed in global warming, and at times I even believed that by 2024, we wouldn't even be able to breathe the air anymore. So, I mean, I was, how can I say how deeply steeped in this I was? I mean, I was completely under the belief that American colonialism consisted of evil, disgusting white men coming and just raping and burning and pillaging these innocent, peaceful Indians living in their teepees and smoking their pipes. I mean, I know some people might be cringing to hear this, and I cringe to even say it. It's embarrassing, but I also think that people have to understand that this is the mindset of young people today. Young people who are completely under the spell of anti-whiteism, this is what they believe. And when I first became red-pilled, you might say, it was an extreme and a hard and fast experience, and it completely blew my mind. And what happened was a friend who I only saw a few times a year from out of town, and she had stayed the night. We'd had a really nice time, and the next morning, as she was about to leave, we got into a conversation, and she just dropped the bomb on me. She said, "Well, you know, the Holocaust never happened, right?" And I mean, I had never even heard anybody say this in my life. I wasn't even aware that there were people who thought this. This is how deeply under the spell I was. And of course my jaw dropped, and I think I even had like some sort of a cold sweat. This was of course back in 2015, and I became very worried about my friend. I started thinking the things that you believe when you watch Hollywood movies, right? About people who think such things. Oh boy, I was so worried about her. I thought she had been brainwashed by neo-Nazis or this sort of thing. And we continued talking, and she was trying her best, which was not trying her best to explain what white genocide was to me and explain the double standards that white people are held to, and to explain that there are racial differences in this sort of thing. And again, she wasn't doing a very good job. Her husband was also a good friend of ours. And so we ended up following up with this conversation. And at one point, I think he just kind of became frustrated with my trying to argue and debate and ask questions. And he said, "Look, the information is out there." He said, "It's not hidden. It's right in front of your face. And if you want to look into it, you're welcome to. Here are some links." And he sent me links to articles from Counter Currents, and he sent me several interviews from Red Ice. And we basically went down that rabbit hole. And I think actually a Red Ice interview back in 2014 or 2015 that you had done, Greg, was one of the first times I was introduced to who is Greg Johnson. Some of the other interviews from that period of time, Stephen McNallen was on there, which, you know, I really appreciate his work as well. I mean, there were quite a few people we were introduced to through Red Ice interviews, actually, with Henrik and Lana. Actually, I'll never forget listening to David Duke rattle on for 3 straight hours in an interview with Lana. And it was just, it just completely blew our minds. And I remember back then, which it feels like so long ago, I do remember there would be moments where we'd kind of look at each other and be like, "Wait, like, are we, like, is this right? Like, are we going crazy? Or, you know, is this real?" But I mean, every single time you just come back to, well, it's the truth. It's honestly difficult to put words to what that feels like, to finally like know truth. And I think that I felt a lot of anger, to be honest. I felt a lot of anger that I had gone through my life in complete ignorance of these truths. And I felt angry that why at the very least in public school are we not being told about these millions of people who were murdered by those other than, you know, the SS? Or, you know, just, oh my gosh. I mean, I could go on and on, but.
You and your husband sort of red-pilled together after you had this fateful conversation with a friend. That's really interesting. Did you sort of egg one another on? Or who did one of you take the lead or the other? How did this unfold? It sounds like a great story, actually.
Yeah, well, you know, it is a great story. And like I said, it feels miraculous, but I would certainly have to credit Red Ice hugely. Around this time, they were covering this topic really well. And I think that it may be because they too were around that time kind of coming to this understanding. Having previously, I know a lot of the interviews that they had been doing were more on kind of esoteric and you know, other types of topics. And white identity was something that came into focus largely on Red Ice around that time period. But we would binge. We would just basically binge listen to interviews and podcasts. And it was like from one subject to another. Like this is great news. We didn't all actually come out of Africa. I want to listen to that one, you know. And then, how about South Africa? Really? There's another side to that story too. And it was just, you know, pivoting from topic to topic to topic. And then Tim Murdoch's fantastic cartoons. I mean, just articles from Counter Currents. I mean, I know there's more, just essentially learning about it. And, you know, the thing is that 7 years ago, I was a good bit younger, I suppose, than I am now, and maybe a little bit more trusting and naive. And so with some of my closest female friends, I felt compelled to share with them what my friend had shared with me. Right. And it was not received the same way. And so that's actually how some of these rumors were initially started. And when Antifa first started coming to market back in 2017, because, you know, the local leftists were very upset and angry that some of their favorite gardener farmers were talking about these things.
Yeah, yeah. This is how a lot of people I know have been doxxed. It's because they started out educating themselves, often in public, often in social media or in conversations with friends, and they moved along and became more radical. And their circle of friends contained a lot of people who were not amused and were not going along with it. And at a certain point, people like that started doxing them, or at least provided clues that allowed more actively malevolent parties to dox people. So there was this guy, this Orthodox Jew from New York, it's this doctor, Dov Bechler, who was commenting at Counter Currents for a long time, and he got doxed. And this was a pretty fascinating story. And it was clear that he was doxed because of his social media. Basically, he was talking about a lot of these discoveries that were animating him with people who were not receptive. And I've known a couple of other people who've had the same experience. And you can't be too hard on yourself. I mean, this is the process that we all go through, this process of discovery. And yes, when you are discovering these things, it's natural to talk about them. And you go slowly, you go in baby steps. And it's often not possible to perceive where you cross a line with a particular friend or relative or lurker, somebody you forgot is even looking at your Facebook or whatever. And so it very naturally happens. And so when that pattern started asserting itself, I told a lot of friends, I said, look, you've got to tighten things up, because especially in 2017, when doxing was going really crazy, I said, you've got to have two Facebook profiles, your one for friends and family and your other for being a dissident and things like that, because it became too dangerous. But we had to expect this reaction to come eventually, but it still was surprising when it happened with a lot of people. And I think the system got really, really scared. And I'm glad they got scared, frankly. I'm glad we went from being irrelevant to being something that they started worrying about. Of course, the trouble with that is that they started harassing us and deplatforming us and trying to ruin our lives. But it was at least a sign that we were having some effect. And at that point, a lot of people faced a choice. And this was especially true in the immediate aftermath of Unite the Right in 2017. A lot of people had the choice of heading for the hills and disappearing or standing up to it. And whenever somebody stands up to this kind of stuff, I want to meet them and shake their hand and congratulate them and thank them. And I want to thank you, Sarah, and your husband for sticking with it publicly. And I think it's wonderful that you've created this business. I'm a coffee snob too. I love coffee. All due respect to Laura and Grandma Towler and their tea, which is excellent. I just drink more coffee than tea, you know? And so I'm really delighted also that you're based in the States, so it's easy to get a hold of your products. And I'm looking forward to trying some out. I was about to order some, and then you announced, well, we've been overwhelmed with orders, and we've had to stop billing them for a while. And I understand, though, that you're about ready to start filling orders again. So if people want to buy your wares, when can they start shopping again? The URL is nabobtimecoffee.com. When can they start shopping?
Thanks, Greg. Yeah, we have been working to fulfill the orders that we've already received, and we're almost done with that. But we are actually going to be opening up the shop for sales and for coffee this evening. So sometime between 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern time, people will be able to hop back on the website and put the coffee in their cart and check out. So that's good news for everyone, I think.
Oh, yeah. Excellent. Another thing that I really like, I like your design concept. I think the site looks really nice. I like your logo. I think your merchandise looks really nice. The mugs are very cool. I definitely want to get one of your oatmeal glazed mugs. That's about just the right size for me. And I'm going to definitely try out your decaf and also your sort of your I guess I'm not into really dark coffees. I like the more medium roast sort of mellow blends. And so I'm definitely going to check out everything that fits that bill as well as your decaf. So I'm glad to know that. I'm going to get my orders in very soon.
Great. Thank you. I also wanted to mention that the mugs, which are out of stock currently, but that's because they're handmade by a fellow like-minded person here in the United States. So each one is made by hand. So those do take time, but we will have more mugs hopefully within the next couple of weeks. And also, Greg, you might have noticed we have our house blend, which is actually quite mellow, I would say. It's a medium roast, and it's a blend of Ethiopian and Sumatran coffees, is named Hagalaz. So it's named actually after the Hagalaz rune, which held a lot of significance for considering what all happened with the docks and the protests and kind of, I guess, what I might call a year of hell in 2019. Hagalaz was a rune that really stuck with us pretty heavily through all of that due to a dream that I had actually had the night that the docks was published about hail and the rune Hagalaz, which essentially, and I know there's quite a few different viewpoints for those who are into runes, but from my understanding, the Hagalaz rune very much is representative of newness, good things and newness that can come out of destruction and chaos. It's kind of like that cyclical thing, and you know, riding through a storm into, you know, a beautiful sunrise on the other side, sort of a thing. So that's what inspired the name for our house blend.
Oh, that's great. That's great. So tell us about some of the other coffees. Why not? I want people out there to be salivating at the prospect of ordering your products. So tell us about what's on sale currently or will soon be on sale, your different blends. Tell us a bit about your merchandise. Also, tell us a bit about who you worked with for the design of your merchandise and your labels and the website. Because I really respect the style of it. I think it looks quite sharp.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, we have been very fortunate to actually have a couple of close, trusted friends step forward to help us with the graphic design as well as the website. So I cannot take any credit for the website or the logo. Those were both designed by close friends of ours, and we are just immensely grateful for their help. Both of them are wishing to remain anonymous at this point in time, so I can't name them. They might be listening right now. They know how much we appreciate them. But yeah, it was perfect. I think it was a great example of when people are working together and they're on the same wavelength and things come together perfectly. And both of them were able to do what we wanted, the exact look and vibe that we wanted, while also kind of maintaining their own, you know, personal creativity with it. Like, for instance, the way that the logo spins on the website, that was a really special touch that our friend added. That was a surprise to us, which we adore. And as far as the other merchandise, we have t-shirts, which we're a little bit low on right now, but we are having some more of those printed. Those are being printed by a fellow white nationalist here in the United States as well. So we're trying to keep everything, you know, kind of all within our movement as much as we can, and, you know, cooperating with other artisans for the mugs and the t-shirts. And then as far as the coffees go, as you mentioned, we do have a decaf. We want people to know that our decaf is not just any decaf. It's actually Swiss water processed, which is a natural method of decaffeinating the coffee so that it's not laced with toxic chemicals. It's also organic. And our dark roast that we're going to be offering when we reopen the shop this evening is no longer going to be Colombian. Actually, we're going with Brazilian because we have fallen in love with Brazilian natural processed coffee. So in the processing of coffee, which is like a cherry, so it's, coffee's actually not a bean. Some of the listeners might not know that. I didn't know that until I started looking into this. But the coffee cherries are harvested, and then there's certain methods of processing and drying them once they're harvested. So washed is the most common type of coffee bean that you'll come across. And if you can get your hands on what's called natural processed, that's what this Brazilian is. And what that is that the coffee beans or cherries are dried with the pulp still on, and then it's removed after drying. So it actually imparts a very special kind of flavor profile to the coffee. It's not anything overwhelming, but it's just really lovely. So it's almost a little tiny bit fruity, but there's also almost kind of like a cocoa or chocolatey, kind of very smooth, very velvety. It's our new favorite coffee. So we're offering our Brazilian as our dark roast. And then we also are offering the New England, otherwise known as a light roast, and that is a coffee from Mexico. So that's going to be very light, a little bit fruity, a little bit citric.
So I love the name of your dark roast, the Hoosier Berean dark roast. I think that's quite clever. Are you going to still keep that name even though you're changing the coffee? Or?
Yeah, we kind of went back and forth on that. I think that we're going to go ahead and stick with the name because it's significant as well. It's kind of a local joke. As I mentioned earlier, the nationalist community and network in Indiana has grown very strong. And so there's a little bit of a joke that, you know, we have this Hoosier Borean supremacy. And then of course, you know, Hyperborean meme and all that. So.
Well, that's great. So how do you brew coffee? I'm always curious about that. There are so many different ways of doing it, and people have strong opinions generally about what's the best way of brewing coffee. So what's your preferred method? And do you think that the roasts that you've created are more suited for one brewing method or another?
Well, I think that that's certainly a matter of preference. And from what I've learned, which I'm still learning, I do not claim to be a coffee guru at all. I still have a lot to learn. But from what I've learned, pretty much any medium to dark roast can be used for an espresso, for instance, and that it's just very much dependent on the origin and the way that the coffee is processed that are going to influence the flavor and the final product as far as the espresso goes. But we, being that we are gardeners and into the homesteading thing, we're pretty much diehard French press people. And each morning we grind our coffee fresh and we brew a large French press full. And we will easily drink that. And sometimes we'll make a whole nother French press. So that's how we've been drinking coffee for as long as I can remember. That's probably what we're going to stick with.
Well, I'm a French press enthusiast. I'm a purist for that as well. I love that it's so low tech. It is the simplest, low-tech form of brewing coffee. And I think it actually has the best flavor, frankly. I have friends who like to do the filter cone drip thing. I find that often that'll take coffees that have really kind of mellow tastes, and they seem to come out more acidic that way, at least to my taste buds. And I just don't get any reason for having elaborate electric machines when I haven't gotten any better coffee than from a French press. And it's just so low tech. It's so foolproof. It works even when the electricity is off. And the French presses, of course, anything can be expensive given this world, but generally they're very, very cheap if you just get a basic one. So it's my favorite kind of coffee machine, if you will. It's the simplest coffee machine, and I think it produces the best flavor.
Yeah, I would have to agree. I will say that I do enjoy a nice cappuccino every once in a while, but it's a little bit more of a treat, I suppose.
So if there are folks out there listening who are thinking about starting their own little business, what advice do you have for them? I think this is very important. I want more of our people to be business owners, even small business owners, even cottage industry owners, rather than being people who are wage slaves, because you just have more freedom, freedom of thought. You go back to the 19th century in America, 19th century American populists were very, very open about this. It was explicit as part of their ideology. They wanted a producer's democracy, where there were lots of self-employed people who could have the freedom to stand up for their own opinions. And I think that our populism needs to have that same kind of ethos. The more of us who are producers, even small producers, small business owners, the more independent that we're going to be. And that means that we're going to have greater ability to speak our minds and to create positive change in the world. So do you have any basic business advice? And if you just want to cite a few books or podcasts or whatever, anything that's helpful to other people out there thinking about this, please do share it.
Yeah, well, I would say that from what I've gathered in conversations with friends and acquaintances is that something that's often overlooked when somebody gets excited about an idea is the laws and regulations about any said business. So that's something, you know, that we had to make sure to cover ourselves on here. And we ran into some surprises that we weren't expecting. You know, coffee, for instance, is a very low risk food product, but because it is a food product, there's certain laws surrounding it versus something like making soap or that sort of thing. So looking into your local laws, especially if it's food related, you know, talking to your local health department, being able to collect sales tax and making sure you have the right licensing, business insurance, and having a very good trustworthy CPA is something I would highly recommend, so that they can make sure that you're registering your business as the right kind of business, whether it's an LLC or an S corporation, etc. I mean, that would probably be my most basic advice. And to be honest, I don't really consider myself much of a businesswoman. It's not something that I've studied, but I've always had you know, a strong kind of entrepreneurial spirit, you might say. I think that I inherited that from my parents, who were both self-employed for most of their lives. So I think that if you have enough drive and you're excited about something, then, you know, you can do it, even if you don't have experience with it. You just, all the information is out there. You just have to access it, make sure that you're above reproach when it comes to licensing and regulations and that sort of thing. And drawing upon, you know, the network has been helpful for us. Drawing upon friendships that we've made over the years has been immensely helpful. I don't know what we would have done without our friend who built our website for us, because, you know, we can't just go on to GoDaddy or Wix or one of these, you know, website hosts and use their templates, because we, being dissident minds, dissident people, and having a political business that serves fellow white nationalists, these were things we had to take into account so that we could avoid deplatforming. Things like that. Find a niche. There's many. There are many niche, you know, many niches to fill. So I suppose that would probably be all the advice that I have, you know, at this time.
That's great. One thing that I like to do occasionally is look at listicles, practical listicles. And so every once in a while, I will Google, you know, five habits that are very, you know, five things that highly successful people do, right? Lists like that, because sometimes they're very, very interesting and very, very helpful. Are there particular little tricks of the trade that make you more organized, more productive, that have really helped you become an entrepreneur as you and your husband are? If you'd like to share some of those, that would be great as well, because I'm always looking for new tips on being more productive with my time.
Oh, well, I might disappoint you, to be honest, Greg. I often feel very disorganized. So I don't know if I have a whole lot of tips with that, to be honest, like between homeschooling the children during the first part of the day and then tackling, you know, household tasks like food prep and tidying up, and then, you know, managing and running a business on top of that, I oftentimes feel like I'm not keeping up with everything as well as I should be. But I think that that's just life. And, you know, no matter what you're doing, if you're an active person, then that's often the situation. I don't know if I really have a whole lot of tips other than you have to have a drive. You can't be lazy. So you just got to work hard, I suppose. If you want something, you have to make time.
So tell me, how many children do you have? And you're doing a business and homeschooling too. That's really impressive.
Thanks. Yeah, we have three children, three sons, actually. We feel very lucky. And our eldest is kind of entering into his teen years, and we've been homeschooling his whole childhood. And that's what we'll always do. We always knew that we wanted to homeschool. And even before waking up to the truth, we knew we wanted to homeschool. So it's incredibly important, in my opinion, especially knowing what we know. And with what's happening with the school system now and how bad it's gotten.
That's wonderful. One thing that I found on a lot of these lists that is helpful and that I've always done is just work from lists. I'm always putting lists of things to do down and prioritizing and just working through lists. Are you a list maker?
Yes, I am, actually. My eyes lit up as soon as you said that, because if I had any tip, I suppose that would be the one. I'm also reorganizing the list and rewriting them daily and transferring whatever didn't get done yesterday onto today's list and that sort of thing. So yeah, very much a list maker in that way.
Yeah, I've always done that. And it's absolutely crucial, because when you have a lot of details to deal with, you simply don't have the short-term memory to juggle all these little variables. And if I don't write these things down, I forget things and things slide. So yeah, I keep lists. I also keep a notebook handy wherever I am in case I need to jot down an idea. And I somewhat ruefully call it my short-term memory, because honestly, if I don't write things down, there's just so much information, so many ideas, I'll forget things. And so I have notebooks all over the place where I'm jotting ideas down, and then I'll transfer them to my lists. I have a sort of station, a special desk that I basically just use for keeping track of projects. I don't work there. I just plan there. And I find that having a separate space where I plan and just keeping lists and also keeping a notebook handy for jotting down ideas are extremely good. And a lot of these articles that I'll read where people, you know, business people or whatever, artists, entrepreneurs, will list things that they do that are helpful. List making and keeping a notebook handy are two things that pretty much always pop up on these lists. So I highly recommend both of those.
Oh, yeah, I would completely agree. And I also really delight in a brand new notebook. Do you know that feeling where you have a brand new fresh notebook you haven't written in yet?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I didn't realize.
New thoughts, you know, and new ambitions. You know, it's like, clean sheets. I can start making new plans. And then I start getting bigger and bigger plans when I'm starting out a new notebook, I think.
Absolutely.
So we're coming up on an hour, and I've really enjoyed making your acquaintance finally. Tell us a little bit more, I guess, just to wrap up, anything you'd like to communicate to the audience. For instance, some of the things that you think that people should be doing. If somebody's listening to this live stream, chances are they're part of our community. And I'm always encouraging people in our community to do what's comfortable for them. You know, and I don't want to be badgering them to not do things that are in their comfort zone. They can determine their own level of involvement, et cetera. But I'm always encouraging people to do more too. So do you have any advice to fellow movement people that you would love to see happen, see more of?
Well, yeah. I mean, I suppose the first thing that stands out to me is how fortunate I feel that we've made the friends that we have made over the years. And we would have never formed these friendships if we hadn't have involved ourselves. And you know, for instance, even though I was doxxed as having been a member of Identity Europa, the friends that we made through that organization and just through the movement in general have lasted with us for a long time. And I know that they will be long friendships. So that would be my first piece of advice to anybody who's listening, is that if you're not connected, you need to get connected somehow, whether it's attending conferences or meetings, or, you know, just there's so many ways. There's actually a great resource that has recently been created by an anonymous creator called the Third Position Directory. And there one can access a list of anything related to our movement, whether it's organizations, social clubs, active clubs, businesses within the movement, book publishers, and any, you know, everything else. So that's a great resource for people. Make friends. The network is strong. It's stronger than it has been in my 7 years of being involved. I think it's only going to grow, especially as our enemies continue to increase the pressure on white people. And as the violent crimes against white people increase, these terrorist attacks that we're seeing happening so much more often, as all of these things increase, these networks are only going to become stronger. So people, please get involved, and you'll find a family that you might not have ever known existed. And from there, you know, there are a lot of resources. You know, people, once you're connected and networked, you might find help with pursuing projects that you're interested in, or, you know, things or business startups that you're wanting to do. And also, it's just not good for anyone to be isolated. So
I think that's very good advice. A lot of our people are isolated. There have been many occasions where I've met with somebody and they have said, either before or at the end of the meeting or whatever, by the way, this is the first time I've ever met an actual person in the movement. And I felt honored to be that person. And I tried to introduce them to more people, because ultimately we're not going to win if we just stay online and we don't have any real relations with people. Once we start having real relations, then we have a real community. We have a community that can't be interrupted by censorship. Face-to-face community is how the world works. The people who rule us are ruining our civilization. They meet face-to-face. They have their conclaves and conferences, the Bilderberger conferences, and you know, private clubs and exclusive restaurants and little get-togethers and retreats where they speak face-to-face. They want the rest of us, though, to be isolated. They want the rest of us to be home alone with the cat, ordering food from DoorDash and staring at screens, preferably screens that are putting their message direct into people's minds. So they're worried about social media for a long time, because it allowed us to establish connections where we could send our own messages rather than just passively absorb theirs. And they're still worried about that. But face-to-face community is the way the world works, and it's the next step for our cause. And I'm hoping that after the trauma, let's call it the trauma of Charlottesville in 2017 and the aftermath of that, and then the sort of fallout from that through 2018. Then, of course, there was basically 2 years of COVID. 2 years of COVID really put a damper on movement activism, especially in Europe for some reason, and especially put a damper on movement meetings in Europe. I'm glad things are happening now in the United States. I'm going to be at AMREN this year, for instance, and there are other events happening, Countercurrents is organizing events around the country. And so we want to get back out there and get people meeting and working again. And that's one thing that Countercurrents has been involved in since the start. We've had events. We organized the New York Forum and the Northwest Forum. We had our weekend retreats. We would do dinners and things like that, Toastmasters style luncheons and other meetings that allowed networking to happen. So I very much agree with that. I think it's very important to take that little risk, to take one step out your door and actually meet somebody in the real world. I think that makes a lot of difference.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
Well, Sarah, do you have some social media links that we can share just to wrap up? Because I would like people to follow you if you're on Telegram or if you're on Twitter, Facebook, whatever.
Yes. So Above Time Coffee Roasters is on Telegram. That is the platform that I'm most active on. We're also on Twitter and Instagram, as well as Gab. And it's Above Time Coffee Roasters, pretty much across the board on all of those accounts. We do also have an Odyssey channel. However, we haven't published anything to it yet. Hopefully we will in the future. And in the near future, once we get approved, we'll have a Subscribestar account as well.
I think that's excellent. So thank you, Sarah. I'm going to put the link to your Telegram channel in the chat at Odyssey, and I'm following it myself. And I urge everyone out there to follow. I urge everyone out there to look at your website. And I urge all the coffee drinkers out there to help you out. I know you're doing great work. You're putting out great products. And I think that whenever we can, other things being equal, we should buy from our own. So I support Grandma Towler's Tea. I'm supporting your project as well. I'm urging people to buy books from Antelope Hill. And also, I put the link to the 3P directory, the third position directory, in the chat over at Odyssey. That is an immensely useful service because I was surprised. I was genuinely surprised at the number of companies and platforms that I hadn't heard of yet. And it's actually very, very encouraging. There is a growing movement out there. And even though people are saying, oh, we've been deplatformed, oh, woe is us, you know, the number of people who are watching live streams is going down, our favorite people aren't on YouTube anymore, the truth is that the movement is growing. The number of platforms is growing, the number of businesses is growing, and Above Time Coffee is one of the new ones. So I very much encourage everyone out there to support this project. Thank you, Sarah, for coming on. And I want to set a time when you can come back and tell us how things are going, how things are developing.
Well, Greg, it's been an absolute pleasure to chat with you and to have this wonderful opportunity to come on the show and share with your listeners about our coffee. I thank you so much for that. And also, I just want to thank everyone for your support for our business. I hope that everyone knows how much it means to us. This is a family business, and we just can't thank you guys enough for your support. It's been just incredible. So thank you.